Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today on our Capitol Report, we'll have the latest from Washington, D.C. on Congress avoiding a government shutdown short term and a warning from the president about the need for a long-term solution. We'll tell you about a lawsuit filed by the ACLU challenging a Catholic hospital chain for denying care to women suffering life-threatening pregnancy complications and miscarriages, a lawsuit that has major implications nationally for both women's health and religious freedom. Governor Brown has signed a bill into law to help protect heart health, and it's patterned after a defibrillator law passed right here in San Diego. Soitec's controversial solar project in Boulevard is up before the supervisors again October 14th, and we'll tell you why on today's Green Scene Report. San Diego County is hosting forums on mental health, seeking the public's ideas on how funding should be spent to help those with mental health issues. From Public News Service, hear why energy companies are testifying today about issues of major importance to the solar industry and to consumers seeking to go solar. And on our agricultural report, we'll tell you about a major fast food company that's announced plans to switch to eggs from cage-free chickens. On our Crime Beat report, hear about an attempted kidnapping of a woman in Spring Valley. Then on our Sounds of History segment, we are delighted today to interview Roberto Alvarez, a college professor who was recently named a living legend by the County of San Diego Library. He'll be talking about his research into immigration history in our region and the amazing facts that he discovered about his own family's role in a landmark case known as the Lemon Grove Incident that ended segregated schools in Lemon Grove. If you're looking for a new career, we'll have some tips for you today from Public News Service about web developer training being offered right here in San Diego, and it's free. This is National Fire Prevention Week, and we'll have some tips for you on wildfire safety and why this wet weather doesn't mean that we could be complacent about the start of fire season and a return of those Santa Ana winds. We'll also have details on a wildfire risk map now available and some info on a bill awaiting the governor's action that would let motorists fight traffic tickets without having to pay fines up front. Today, we will also be re-airing Connie Beck's Ready, Set, Grow episode with advice on some beautiful fall trees that you can plant this season. We'll have all that information and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Bill Driscoll with a Capitol Report. A government shutdown has been averted, at least for now. Conservative Republicans in Congress had sought to deny passage to a spending bill unless all funding for Planned Parenthood was eliminated. That effort was blocked by House Democrats. If no spending measure was passed by September 30th, the government would have been shut down. Now a stopgap measure has been passed to fund the government, but only until December 30th. President Barack Obama signed the short-term spending bill, but warned that he will veto what he calls short-sighted spending bills in the future. He wants Congress to assure long-term, stable funding for the U.S. government, including both military and domestic programs. The president urged Republicans not to hold a spending measure hostage over a single issue, such as Planned Parenthood funding, noting that many liberals feel strongly on issues such as gun control, but that strong sentiments over any single issue should not be used to, quote, wreck the economy.
The American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, has filed a lawsuit seeking an injunction to stop a national chain of Catholic hospitals from withholding care to pregnant women with serious pregnancy complications. Trinity Health owns 80 Catholic hospitals nationwide, so the suit has major implications for women's health care and religious freedom. According to the lawsuit, pregnant women seeking emergency care at Trinity Health's hospitals have experienced hemorrhaging or severe bleeding, contracted life-threatening infections or sepsis, and suffered severe pain for days after being denied medical care during pregnancy complications and during miscarriages. In some cases, the water or the membrane surrounding a fetus bursts during the early stages of pregnancy, meaning a baby could not possibly survive and the mother's life was in danger without termination of pregnancy due to infection setting in. But the Catholic Hospital's directives prohibit doctors from terminating a pregnancy for any reason, even when a miscarriage is in progress, or even telling a woman that an abortion could save her life or protect her health. The ACLU filed the suit on behalf of women members, including some who live in cities and counties where Trinity is the only hospital providing emergency care for obstetrical and gynecological conditions, or where Trinity is the only hospital that takes the members' health insurance. While the ACLU has fought for First Amendment freedoms, including religion, it has also fought to assure that religious exemptions to laws do not harm others. Trinity's chain of hospitals is causing harm to women, putting lives and health at risk due to religious views, the suit makes clear. The case is filed in Michigan, but it could have broad-ranging implications for other religious hospitals and medical institutions across the nation. The ACLU suit contends that Trinity is violating the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, as well as the Rehabilitation Act. The Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act requires that any hospital which receives Medicare funds and operates an emergency department must stabilize a person in an emergency medical condition to assure that their condition does not deteriorate. The Rehabilitation Act considers some pregnancy complications to be disabilities, and it prohibits federally funded programs from denying benefits or discriminating against anyone based on her disability. At other hospitals, termination of pregnancy is sometimes recommended to stabilize a patient, such as when significant blood loss or serious infection has occurred, or when underlying heart or kidney disease causes a woman to experience an emergency medical condition that threatens her life. Trinity's Catholic hospitals do provide induction of labor as well as dilation and curettage under other circumstances, but not when these same procedures will result in termination of a pregnancy any time after conception. The ACLU says that policy is discriminatory against women suffering severe and disabling complications. As a result of the hospital's religious views, the ACLU concludes, these women did not receive emergency care that they were otherwise qualified to obtain solely by reason of their disabilities and suffered harm as a result. The ACLU seeks a permanent injunction to prohibit the hospital chain from withholding emergency abortion care from pregnant women suffering emergencies that put their lives or health at risk. The suit would force defendants to provide stabilizing treatment, including pregnancy termination if such treatment is the standard of care for those with emergency medical conditions. It would also require that women patients suffering pregnancy-related disabilities be provided full access to both information and services, including pregnancy termination. If successful, the suit would not force Catholic doctors to provide abortion, but it could require that hospitals receiving federal dollars and providing emergency services must have a medical professional on staff who could provide termination of pregnancy in a serious medical emergency. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Bill Driscoll with a health report from East County Magazine on KNSJ. Senate Bill 287, the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Safety Act, has been signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown. The bill was authorized by State Senator Ben Hueso, a Democrat representing San Diego and the southern portions of East County. The new law will require that buildings constructed after January 2017 with an occupancy of 200 or more must install an automated external defibrillator or AED on site. AEDs can diagnose life-threatening cardiac arrest and treat a heart attack, restoring the heart's normal rhythm. Current law requires AEDs only in fitness centers or gyms. The new law will dramatically expand the availability of AEDs, increasing survival rates after heart attacks across California, Senator Hueso says. He also says time matters. For every minute following sudden cardiac arrest without defibrillation from an AED, an individual's chance of survival decreases by 10%. The immediate use of an AED can drastically increase the survival rate by 70%. An estimated 350,000 people in the United States suffer sudden cardiac arrest each year. Of those, over 52,000 die from sudden cardiac arrest at the workplace, public parks, commercial buildings, streets, highways, or transit centers. According to the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Foundation, the number of people who die from sudden cardiac arrest is equivalent to the number of people who die from Alzheimer's disease, assault with firearms, breast cancer, cervical cancer, colorectal cancer, diabetes, HIV, house fires, motor vehicle accidents, prostate cancer, and suicides combined. SB 287 was inspired by a similar measure passed by the San Diego City Council back in 2008.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's Green Scene Report on KNSJ. San Diego supervisors will hold a hearing on October 14th on Rugged Solar, Soitec's last remaining industrial-scale solar project in Boulevard. A judge voided that project's environmental impact report because 160 massive battery storage units the size of freight cars were added after the public comment period closed. The court action came after a lawsuit filed by two nonprofits, Backcountry Against Dumps and the Protect Our Communities Foundation. Now, the developer is asking supervisors to recertify the environmental documents with the battery units removed. Soitec originally proposed four projects, two of which were approved by the county for construction, Rugged Acres and Tierra del Sol, but the financially troubled French company Soitec later announced it has exited the solar business, despite receiving $25 million in federal money for its solar manufacturing facility in Rancho Bernardo. Soitec sold the Rancho Bernardo facility to Concern Solar and withdrew its plans for Tierra del Sol, but pressed forward on Rugged Solar at the gateway to McCain Valley, a federal recreation area and gateway to multiple federal wilderness preserves. Four out of five supervisors initially voted to approve the project, which would help the county meet the state's mandate for renewable energy. Only Supervisor Diane Jacob opposed the project, which also drew support from State Senator Joel Anderson, who was announced intent to run against Jacob in 2016. Rugged Solar has drawn strong community opposition over concerns that included destruction of meadows and wetlands, habitat and scenic views, as well as increased fire danger and depletion of groundwater for construction. Residents have also argued that the project in essence overturned the general plan for the community, opening the door for industrialization of this rural area in our backcountry. The October 14th hearing will be held at the County Administration Building downtown.
This is Bill Driscoll with a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. Do you or a loved one have a mental health challenge? Do you have ideas about what behavioral health programs and services are needed in your community? If so, the county wants to hear from you. The County of San Diego Health and Human Services Agency is seeking input from the public and professionals about the types of mental health programs needed in San Diego County. 12 regional forums will take place throughout the county in October to gather input from people living with mental illness, their families, and behavioral health service providers. To find a list of the forums with details on dates and locations, and to register to attend a forum in your area, you can visit www.up2sd.org. That's UP and the numeric 2, the letter S and the letter D.org. The information gathered will help the county determine how to spend federal and state funding, including funds from the Mental Health Services Act, which was approved by California voters in 2004.
The big three California utility companies are going before the Public Utilities Commission in San Francisco today to argue for changes in the way people with rooftop solar are compensated for the energy they feed back into the grid. Right now, under the net metering program, solar owners are credited at the same rate the utilities charge. Evan Gillespie with the Sierra Club says the changes the utilities want would take away the savings that lead people to install rooftop solar.
Well, if utilities succeed in making these changes, only the very, very rich are going to be able to afford solar going forward, and that's a big problem because it's also taking away one of the single greatest tools that we have to fight climate change and clean up our air.
San Diego Gas and Electric, Pacific Gas and Electric, and Edison would like to cut compensation to homeowners by about half and charge higher connection fees, arguing that solar owners don't contribute enough to the upkeep of the grid. The Public Utilities Commission has until the end of the year to make a decision. Gillespie says the utilities' argument doesn't hold up because solar generators reduce the demand for power from dirtier, more expensive sources and improve grid reliability.
It's a nice story that they've yet to demonstrate data to back up. We just made significant changes to how customers pay their bills. Going forward, every Californian is going to be paying about $10 a month on their bill to cover these types of infrastructure charges.
The Sierra Club will hold rallies on this subject over the next 3 weeks in San Diego, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they leave Paris?
This is Bill Driscoll with an agricultural report. 2 billion eggs a year are purchased by McDonald's for its Egg McMuffins and other menu items. Now, the giant fast food company has announced it will transition to buy 100% of its eggs from suppliers who raise cage-free chickens. The move is hailed as a win by animal rights advocates who had been lobbying McDonald's and other major food retailers to make their supply chain more humane. McDonald's president Mike Andrus acknowledges that the company's customers are increasingly interested in knowing more about their food and where it comes from, the Wall Street Journal reported. The company also recently began serving hormone-free milk. The food industry has drawn criticism for its reliance on chickens raised in cramped cages, but only 10% of the nation's egg-laying hens are cage-free, the federal government reports. California voters passed a measure several years ago to require larger cages, but now a growing number of companies are going farther, shifting to cage-free poultry. Those include Starbucks, Burger King, General Mills, and Nestle, among others. The move to more humane practices does, however, come with a price. The cost of eggs has gone up about 67 cents a dozen in California over other states, though the price of eggs has risen nationwide due to a bird flu epidemic that resulted in the deaths of several million chickens earlier this year. McDonald's will be phasing in its cage-free eggs over the next 10 years. The Humane Society of the United States issued a press release stating it is proud to have spearheaded a movement that over the last decade has resulted in sweeping change in how our nation farms and eats. That movement has also freed calves from being confined in veal crates and helped free pregnant pigs from cramped gestation crates. The Humane Society concludes, "We're making these practices illegal or at least unacceptable. The public gets it, and increasingly so does the food industry. We're driving the market away from cage products and toward more humane and sustainable practices."
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. Two men in a white sedan attempted to kidnap a woman who was walking on the sidewalk near Gillespie Drive in Spring Valley on October 3rd at 5:15 p.m. One of the suspects is described as a black man, 20 to 25 years old, with a shaved head. He's about 5 feet 8 inches tall and weighs 150 pounds. The second suspect is a man of unknown race. The vehicle, a white sedan, may possibly be a Chevrolet Impala, and it had blacked-out windows. According to Sergeant Pat McAvoy with the San Diego Sheriff, the vehicle pulled alongside the woman and stopped. Two men got out of the car and attempted to force the woman into their vehicle, he said. She fought back against the suspects, and they were unsuccessful. But they did forcibly remove her purse and fled north on Gillespie Street near Orville. The Sheriff's Department is asking anyone who may have witnessed the incident or have information on the suspects or their vehicle to please contact the Rancho San Diego Sheriff's Station at 619-660-7090. You can also remain anonymous and be eligible for up to a $1,000 reward for information leading to an arrest by calling Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Guest hosting today our Sounds of History segment on the East County Magazine show. My very special guest today is Roberto Alvarez. Roberto is a professor emeritus of ethnic studies at the University of California, San Diego, and he's here today to talk to us about some amazing things that he found out while researching his own family history and discovering their role in what's become known as the Lemon Grove Incident. Roberto, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your own family background, for starters.
when your grandparents came to this country?
My grandparents, along with many of the community of Lemon Grove, migrated from Baja California. And it took a long time, you know, a period of, you know, decades to move through a mining district into California. And they crossed the border around 1900, the early decades of the 1900s.
Mm-hmm. So their children were born here. They were all citizens here when the 1930s rolled around. Tell us, when you were doing your college dissertation on immigration, what you found out.
Well, I decided to do my PhD dissertation, and it is in anthropology, on immigration, because there was very little being written at the time on immigration from a humanitarian and anthropological perspective. Most of the work had been done on economics, on the economic push-pull of the larger forces of immigration.
Yeah, so there were no human stories.
No, there were not. There were very few. There were some very early ones in the 1920s that were done. But my reaction was that what I was reading in the literature did not reflect my own background or the background of my family. So I decided to do my dissertation on immigration and do a social history of the migration of my own family into California. During that time, when I began doing the dissertation, I interviewed people who I thought I knew, but these were people that had incredibly full and rich backgrounds that I didn't know about. And I learned of more of the connections of the family within San Diego County and also across the border. In that interviewing, I discovered that people spoke about the school case. And this is something that I had never heard about, or any of my generation had really heard about either. And when I asked my father, what is this school case thing? He said, well, it was a case that occurred in segregation Lemon Grove.
And this was a case that overturned the segregation of a Lemon Grove school. And it turns out that your father, who was also named Roberto Alvarez, was just 9 years old at the time. And it was your grandparents who were among the plaintiffs that filed this landmark case.
That's correct. The community was very unified. And part of this was because they all had known each other through the migration trail. When they got to Lemon Grove, they lived in one section of town. And when they learned of the segregation, they formed what they called the Asociación de Vecinos de Lemon Grove, the Lemon Grove Neighborhood Association, and basically took the case to court.
Basically what happened was these children at one time were in the main school in Lemon Grove. Along came a school board that voted to move all the Mexican-American children, even citizens, into a separate school, a segregated school. This in an era 20 years before the Brown versus Board of Education case in the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1950s eventually overturned segregation nationwide. In that case, it was a school for African-American children. Quite a historic fact.
It is.
Right here.
However, it's interesting that the principal, Jerome Green, was not in favor of the segregation. It was a school board.
So tell us how the parents reacted when the school board built this separate school.
The parents learned about the upcoming segregation. There was a school being built. They called it a school, a building in the Mexican area that was being built specifically for the Mexican-American kids, which they called La Caballeriza, which means the barn.
The barn.
Or the barn or the barnyard. They were incensed, basically, that their children, who they felt deserved to be with other American citizens in the regular school, should be put in a different school. So Juan Gonzalez was also very principal in this, in addition to all the families. But Juan Gonzalez had some dealings with a lawyer in Sonora, I believe it was, who helped with the case. The association got together and they went to the Mexican consul and asked for support. And the support that they received from the consul is kind of tenuous because Mexico can't get involved in U.S. affairs. But it was Fred Noon was the name of the lawyer. Fred Noon took on the case. So anyway, they were very adamant about what they were going to be doing.
And while the lawsuit was working its way through the court, the parents didn't just stand by idly doing nothing. I understand your grandmother was instrumental in this, but they actually pulled their kids out of the school, I understand, and went on strike. Had the kids go on strike.
Well, what happened was they chose I think it was the day after Christmas vacation to separate the kids and take them over to the new school, the Mexican kids. And the principal stood at the door and separated the kids, the Mexican kids from the Anglo kids, And the story is that when he went into the school to place the Anglo kids, the Mexican kids just came home, and they were instructed by their parents not to go to the other school. That's what began the strike. It lasted for several months, I believe.
So they really stood up and took a stand.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Very inspiring. This should be put against the historical backdrop of the times. This was not an isolated case. Tell us a little bit about the historical context of segregation in the era, as well as the anti-immigrant actions that were taking place across America during the 1930s, which was, of course, the Great Depression.
That's really a very important question. And you need to remember that there are some parallels here with what's going on today.
Definitely.
There was a very strong anti-immigrant sense in the country, that the Depression was basically forcing great competition for jobs, of course, and it threatened the larger population. Mexican immigrants were seen as troublemakers, health problems.
Sounds a lot like a Donald Trump speech, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, what happened was that there were almost 500,000 Mexican and Mexican-Americans deported.
Yeah, whole families, I understand.
Families. They were rounded up in Los Angeles in the parks. It was the Hoover administration that initiated that deportation.
Yeah, basically the Donald Trump plan brought to reality way back in the 1930s.
I guess you could say that. But what happened was that during that period of time, there was a tremendous anti-Mexican sentiment. There was a governor's report that came out in 1930 that basically it was called Mexicans in California. It didn't say anything of Mexican Americans or citizens. Everybody was lumped, whether they were citizens or not, as people of Mexican origin.
Yeah.
So that the problem became one of all people of Mexican origin, not just immigrants. So that the people that were deported, and there were people from Lemon Grove that were actually deported who were citizens,
citizens
during that period of time into Mexico. So it's sort of like the Trump thing. And what's frightening, however, is that
almost worse in a sense, because they even deported citizens back.
Well, they
then.
Did deport yeah. citizens, but it's that same mentality.
Yeah, exactly. And the mentality itself really isn't new. It's gone on for hundreds of years, unfortunately. When the Irish were coming over to work the railroads, or the Chinese,
absolutely.
You know, there was anti-immigrant sentiment against them, the Japanese during World War II. Why do you think it is that it seems like whenever times are hard, we also seem to see this rise in anti-immigrant sentiment against whichever group is, you know, has the influx of population at the time?
Well, I believe it's like what I mentioned before, it's really a threat to the so-called majority. And it's basically the white majority. You know, people, the same arguments were being made in the 1930s. The same arguments were made with the Chinese Exclusion Act, etc. You know, they're taking our jobs. They have health problems. They cause troubles. They're criminals, etc., etc. And it's a threat to, the ideology of America. You know, that these people who are not really American are, you know, causing all these problems and issues.
Yeah. And yet almost all of us, unless we're Native American, are descended from immigrants somewhere down the chain. Back to the case in the 1930s. So this moved forward to the courts. The kids went out on strike. They were out for what, 6 months? And your father was one of those?
It was, I believe it was about 6 months.
Yeah. And your dad was how old at the time?
He was nine.
Nine years old, right. What an ordeal for a young child at the time.
You know, I'd like to return to the historical context.
Yes.
Because in addition to being in the Depression period, you know, this was a time when segregation throughout the country was pretty rampant. You know, we have the Jim Crow law, right?
Yeah.
Separate but equal. But this was occurring throughout the Southwest as well. I think that the Lemon Grove school case was one of a good example of that.
I'm curious, given all of these Jim Crow laws, and this was not the only school in California that was segregating out Mexican-American children. There had even been some court cases that backed up the discrimination. What made your grandparents and the other parents that decided to go forward with this case do so? What made them believe they could win?
That's really a good question. I think they just had a lot of integrity. Mm-hmm. And they knew where they were. They knew who their children were. They knew that they were citizens and had rights as citizens in this country.
Yeah, so very courageous action. So ultimately, tell us which court made the decision and what it was.
It was the court here in San Diego, the Superior Court of San Diego County. The decision was that it was indeed a case of segregation. Interestingly, during this period, which again illustrates sort of the long haul of Jim Crow, it was illegal to segregate white children. And at the time, Mexican Americans were considered white.
Interesting.
So that I've heard arguments that, well, they won because they were white. But it goes back to your earlier question that, you know, it took a lot of guts and stamina for those parents to stand up against a school board, given the time that they were in.
And we should note that not every white person in Lemon Grove supported what the school board was doing. In fact, the principal, you've told me, opposed it.
Not at all. In fact, my father said that most of the families were against this kind of a segregated move. It was mainly the school board, for personal reasons, that was really pushing this.
Yeah, some of the comments seemed very racist as the true motivation, but it was interesting because ostensibly in court, the school district tried to argue that this was really in the best interest of the Mexican-American kids because they didn't speak English and they were going to get more help in this school, which was really a shack we're putting them into, and that keeping them in the main school would slow down the progress of the white kids. And the judge did a pretty interesting, pretty effective job of tearing apart those arguments. He asked them, what do you do when you have a slow learner that's a white kid? And of course, they don't segregate them out and send them off to their own school. And so he concluded that, in fact, this was racist and segregation. And he ordered the school to be desegregated 20-something years before the landmark Brown versus Board of Education case.
That's right. What's really interesting, however, is that when they went back to the school, they went back to the Mexican classes. You know, I interviewed people who graduated 10 years later from that school who were still talked about being in the Mexican classes. There were a few people like my dad who spoke very good English, and I think Jesse Gonzalez and a few other folks that were placed with the white kids because they spoke English well, and they were light-complected. So anyway, what I'm getting at is there was still a segregation going on in the school. They were separated, which you can't do today, obviously.
Yeah, it didn't.
The case ended the separation of the children from one school to another school.
But not within the classroom.
In a legal you know, sense.
Very interesting.
But when they went back to school, to the regular school, they were back in separated classes.
And for those listeners that may be wondering, why did it take 20-something years for the Supreme Court to strike down segregated schools? It's because the Lemon Grove School Board decided not to file an appeal, so there never was a precedent set that would apply anywhere else. Why do you think they didn't appeal?
Well, apparently, from the research that we've done, they spent a lot of money building the school.
They just couldn't afford it.
They couldn't afford it, and I think that there was maybe one or two people on the school board that were very adamant about pursuing this. Mm-hmm. The rest of the board felt that it was no longer necessary, that it was, they lost and they should just leave it, let it go.
Now, your family is a true American success story. Your grandparents, as we've mentioned, came here. They picked fruit in the early days in Lemon Grove with all of the orchards and the packing houses that Lemon Grove was known for in those days. And then your father, that 9-year-old boy who was at the center of this firestorm of a case, what did he go on to do when he got done with his schooling?
He was considered one of the hardworking kids around. And he worked for the Stonka brothers, I know that, and got into the grocery business that way. And he joined the Navy and learned bookkeeping in the Navy during the Second World War. And when he returned, he and a cousin, Henry Castellanos, another family that was involved in the school case, went in partners and formed a produce company that became very, very successful and still running today. It's a very successful adventure. He was a very eclectic individual, did a lot of work in Mexico, ended up doing a lot of work throughout the southwestern United States.
I think this is a common story among immigrants where the first generation maybe is laborers, fruit pickers in this case. The son goes on to start a business, serve in the military, run his own produce company, and then the grandson now, you, are a college professor. So quite the success story there. Tell us what happened to some of the other kids that came out of that school and this case.
Well, there were, from that generation, I don't think anyone, there was only a few people, my father and a few others that went to high school, finished high school.
Yeah.
The Depression came along and hit pretty hard, and many of the young men went into the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle,
our country.
Sure, is a good example of that. So most of that generation did not go on to school. They were successful in terms of being, you know, living in the United States and becoming part of the mainstream, pretty much. There was always, even when I was growing up, there was always some discrimination and so on. But that even occurs today.
Yeah.
So, but you know, I do want to go back to you mentioned that spread of time between Lemon Grove and Brown. Brown versus the Board.
Yes.
One of the things that I've come to realize is that when I first learned about the Lemon Grove case, it was an event that none of us knew about in my generation. My parents' generation never even talked about it.
Why do you think that is? Why was it not a story that was passed down through the family, do you believe?
There are two reasons. One, I think, is that my father used to say that it was the parents that did this. It was his parents and the community that was struggled and did this and stood up. They just followed their parents' orders. They did whatever their parents told them to do. They went to court, they went to school, and so on. Retrospectively, I think that he was able to, when we were doing this work, when I actually was doing the research on the school, he took great pride in it and began to speak about it, as well as other people
in the
community.
Yeah, so you went back and talked to him about it when you
Oh, absolutely.
Down.
And we interviewed him. There was a film made. There was a number of things that highlighted the case and made it public.
And we should note that for these efforts that you made to bring this incident to light, you have recently been honored and named a living legend by the San Diego County Library as part of their series honoring citizens here in San Diego County who have done some amazing things in their lifetimes. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. I was humbled by that, and I think it really reflects on the not just on my father, but on the community that I came out of. I think that endeavor to stand up for your rights stuck with us.
Absolutely. You've mentioned that you have another friend who recently went on to achieve some great honors. Tell us about that, another young immigrant of this generation.
I just returned from this last week in Washington, D.C. I went to the Library of Congress because a very close friend, a very intimate friend, Juan Felipe Herrera, was named the Poet Laureate of the United States.
Very good.
He was a son of migrant workers, was born in Fowler, but he spent much time here in San Diego in Logan Heights. He was another individual who struggled and got to school and made it through postgraduate work and became a professor at University of California, Riverside. He was a distinguished professor there. So there are a few of us, but I think that we're the exception. There still needs to be a lot more of us and a lot more exposure about the kinds of work that people like Juan Felipe are doing.
You know, you mentioned exposure. Do you believe that the shifts we've seen in recent years in media toward media outlets where people are tending to sort of self-select media that goes along with their own mindset. In some cases, is that reaffirming prejudices that people have? Are you concerned about a rise in media that does not attempt to follow the fairness doctrine to show all voices or viewpoints that tend to be skewed toward one particular point of view?
I think the media is certainly skewed. All the media to a certain extent. And obviously people listen to what they want to listen to and they like to have their own ideas.
Yeah, and we hear overt hate speech on some of the talk radio in particular.
Well, you can see the sentiment now with Trump, the folks that have that sentiment is being expressed through Donald Trump. But I also think that there's a certain responsibility that we have as individuals and citizens to find out what those differences really are. And I think that comes through our educational system, through being aware of what's going on around us. We seem to focus on those things that suit our own interests rather than branching out a little bit. And I think it really has a lot to do with being able to discern and being educated about what's going on around us so that we can make decisions that are much more logical instead of just...
So you see the educational system as the answer. What about an increase in alternative media outlets such as internet media?
Absolutely.
As well as stations
Absolutely.
Like KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, which is a public educational station.
Obviously, it's the more news that we have, it's just better for people to hear these different things. But the point is, however, that today, everywhere you go, you're looking at a phone. I took a hike in Joshua Tree National Monument when it was this big, long hike. And I get to the top, and everybody has a cell phone.
They do. The kids are all connected.
I mean, there's 20 people up there. Every one of them has a cell phone, and they're connected to whatever it is that they're connected to.
Oh, well, social media is huge now. You look at Twitter. It started a revolution practically over
the years. But it almost annihilates the actual place that they're in, the actual situation that they find themselves in.
So there's power in that, though. There can be. I mean, it can be a distraction if you're out hiking and ignoring nature, but there's also power
Absolutely,
in the ability to
there's
network,
power.
Right?
Absolutely. If you look at how the Middle East arose with Twitter and the fast, you know, the media and so on.
Yeah,
if you look at what happened with the Zapatistas, it was all about the media and reaching out across the world, not just in Mexico or the United States. It was about connecting to that larger media to have something change. And,
yeah. So what message would you send to listeners out there who may be concerned about the parallels that we're seeing today in the national mindset among many people toward immigrants that we also saw back in the 1930s when this Lemon Grove desegregation case occurred?
The first thing is that we have to recognize, as in Lemon Grove, it was a minority, a very small minority of individuals who were pushing this idea of segregation and this sort of hate and anti-immigrant sentiment. It's similar today. It's a minority of individuals who have a lot of voice. For the others, people who are out there, and that's most of us, I believe, it's important to know what the facts are. For instance, today, in the entire history of our country, there's less immigration coming across that border than there ever was.
Very true.
But we still hear the idea of building two fences and
so on and so forth. Gotta secure the borders, even though, immigration is already down.
Even though it's not that adamant. It's really not that severe as people are claiming.
Right, because immigration is down substantially.
It's down substantially. And then you need to look at the contributions that immigrants are making here in this country.
Roberto, you've talked about there being a thread or a stream of cases involving segregation, that Lemon Grove was far from an isolated instance. Tell us about that.
When I first found out about Lemon Grove, because I hadn't known about it, nor my generation had known about it, nor had my parents talked about it, it seemed like an isolated event. So we called it the Lemon Grove Incident. Over the years, however, I've realized that there have been other cases that are tied together over the years. And if you look at it as a larger movement of segregation that ties both black and brown and red and others into the stream.
Yeah, this was an era when we had Native American children being sent off to Indian schools, boarding schools, and black children in all black schools in the South.
Absolutely. So that if you think about it in the long durée, the long stream of history, it begins really in 1850 with Roberts and a case against the Boston School Board, which resulted in Plessy versus Ferguson, which basically resulted in the Jim Crow law, separate but equal.
Yeah.
Well, Jim Crow was also Jose Crow, because throughout the Southwest, Mexicans were also separated exactly as black folks were in the South.
How common were these types of segregated schools in California and the Southwest in that era?
Well, they were very, very common. There were two cases prior to the Lemon Grove case, one in Del Rio, Texas in 1930. There was a 1929 case in Tempe, Arizona that was based on also on segregation.
How did they turn out?
They apparently won. The communities won, but they were overturned in courts afterwards.
And that was appellate courts, but none of them went all the way to the U.S.
Supreme
Court.
None of them went to the U.S. Supreme Court. But after, and remember, these are immigrant communities who are pretty much in contact.
Yeah, so people were standing up for their rights.
They were standing up for their rights, and I think this is something that we forget about, that there was communication, that people are moving back and forth. We talk about migrants who are moving through these periods, and we never talk about the fact that they're communicating, that they're actually telling people what's going on.
Yeah, there was a national media, a Mexican newspaper at the time, I understand, that was covering the Lemon Grove case and getting support for it, financial support and so forth from all over the country.
That's correct. The La Opinion in Los Angeles. There were letters written to La Opinion from the Lemon Grove school, from the Lemon Grove community, asking for support. 9 years after, in Orange County, California, the Mendez versus Westminster case, and 9 years is not that long, considering the fact that you do have media, you have people moving and so on.
Yeah, and this is before the internet, social media, so it took a while for the word to get around.
But the Mendez case was instrumental, and this is a case of Mexican Americans and segregation. It was instrumental in the Brown versus the Board case.
Really?
During that case, Earl Warren, who was the governor of the state of California, ultimately signed segregation, made it illegal, you know, in California.
Oh, interesting. But, and Earl Warren, of course, so he signed the anti-segregation law here, and he went on to become a very influential justice on the Supreme Court.
He was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court during the Brown versus the Board case. Similarly, there were a number of amicus briefs written. These are supports for the plaintiffs, a Jewish American League, the Japanese American League, and a variety of others. And what was included there was also the NAACP.
Do you think these other cases, the other case in California that you just cited, was that influenced at all by the Lemon Grove case? I know it wasn't a legal precedent, but were people connected? Were they hearing what was going on down here? Do you think what happened here maybe inspired people to challenge these laws in other places?
You know, I strongly believe that it was that it was influential.
So the desegregation that started right here in Lemon Grove in San Diego's East County was influential in ultimately helping to overturn segregated schools nationwide through the Brown versus Board of Education case.
In a sense, it was. That's why I emphasize the fact that segregation was going on for a very long time, that it happened in the South. Thurgood Marshall worked with the Texas educators in the 1940s to end segregation in Texas. There was a lot of communication between educators in Texas and Thurgood Marshall at the time.
Mm-hmm. Who became a Supreme Court justice also.
Right.
So Thurgood Marshall was working to end segregation.
Absolutely. The point I'm trying to make is that in the Mendez case, he wrote an amicus brief that basically outlined several of the arguments that were made in the Brown versus the Board that he used in the Brown versus the Board case based on the, you know, constitutional rights of children in the United States to end segregation. So ultimately, Earl Warren from California and Thurgood Marshall, who wrote that amicus brief, sat, you know, in the Supreme Court of the United States and argued, which ended up finally ending segregation in the country. The argument is that the stream of these small cases were not isolated, they were connected, and it was a larger segregation movement that included black and brown folks.
Very good. Listeners, we've been speaking with Roberto Alvarez about his family's role in a landmark case that desegregated the Lemon Grove School back in the 1930s. I want to give you the final words today, Roberto. Thank you so much for joining us. What can people who are concerned about the immigrant bashing that we're seeing today do about it?
Everybody needs to take a stand, basically. Everybody needs to stand up for what's right. And that can be done in a number of ways. It can be done just by voting. But at the same time, we have to recognize that there is this issue and that we all need to get political, basically to get active, to do something about what's going on. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to understand and see what's going on, but there's something else in actually taking action and doing something.
To stand up and speak out, just like your grandparents did and all of the other parents and children back in the 1930s who helped to desegregate a school right here in Lemon Grove in San Diego's East County.
That's correct. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Roberto. It's been an honor. Thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you very much, and it's been an honor to represent community, to represent Lemon Grove, and to be able to say a few words about how important it is to be active, to be concerned with social justice. Thank you.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
A quick search for web developer jobs in California turns up 10,000 positions open right now. But many young people don't have the skills to write code and can't afford college or $10,000 for a coding boot camp. Consequently, many companies are sending the jobs overseas. But a unique nonprofit called SoftStack Factory is trying to reverse those trends. Today, they're starting their first free 12-week coding boot camp in San Diego. SoftStack Factory CEO Harold Gottschalk says the program harnesses the talents of low-income students and gives companies trained local workers, helping keep jobs on American soil.
So it's a great opportunity. They're going to get really exposed to some really cool technology. They'll learn how to build hybrid mobile apps. And then our intention is to try to find companies that are willing to take them on.
SoftStack is looking for businesses to sponsor the boot camps, and in return, the students will produce an app for the company. Gottschalk would like to train up to 200 students a year and offer the course in multiple locations.
Eventually, we'd like to see if we can replicate that model outside of San Diego and other places in California or other places around the country.
The company is currently accepting applications for the next boot camp in January. You don't have to know anything about coding, but you need to be a high school graduate. Women are encouraged to apply. Finalists will take part in a 2-day interview and testing process. To learn more, go to SoftStackFactory.com. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is National Fire Prevention Week. Fire Chief Sam DiGiovanna, our Chief's Corner columnist at East County Magazine, says don't let recent rains fool you. This year's wildfire season is a continuation of last year's due to the drought, he adds. The National Weather Service is forecasting our first significant Santa Ana wind event of the season this week. Residents are advised to prepare now before conditions get worse. Here are some tips to make your property safer during fire season and all year long. Remove all dead plants, grass, and weeds from at least 30 feet around your house. Trim tree branches so that they're at least 10 feet from other trees, and remove branches that are 6 feet or less from the ground. Move any wood piles at least 30 feet away from your house. If your home has a deck, clear out any flammable materials, including vegetation, underneath and around it. Keep a fire extinguisher and tools such as a bucket, rake, shovel, and hoe in your garage. Trim back any overhanging trees or shrubs to allow emergency vehicles room to get access to your house. Cover vents with an 1/8 inch or 1/4 inch metal mesh. Vents can allow embers to enter houses. If vents are in an eave or a cornice, ember-blocking baffles are also needed. Use power equipment outdoors only in the early morning to avoid sparking a wildfire. For more information, contact your local fire department and visit the National Fire Protection Association's website at nfpa.org. For East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Currently, California drivers who want to challenge a ticket in court have to pay a fine or a fee first in many jurisdictions. But Senate Bill 405, now awaiting Governor Jerry Brown's approval, would give motorists the right to fight tickets without paying a fine or a fee unless they are found guilty. The U.S. justice system is supposed to presume innocence until someone is found guilty. But traffic fines and add-on fees amount to hundreds of dollars in some cases. The American Civil Liberties Union has argued that those fees block access to the justice system for the poor. That has caused over 4 million California residents to lose their driver's license because they couldn't afford to pay fines for traffic violations or didn't appear in court, often because they lacked the money to pay. Senate Bill 405 passed the legislature almost unanimously, with only a single vote cast against letting motorists fight tickets free. The governor has until October 11th to sign or veto the measure, after already signing a second measure that grants partial amnesty to Californians with overdue traffic fines. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Tasha Matthews.
This is Marilyn Lyons from East County Magazine with some important news on wildfire safety. As San Diego County enters the perilous fall wildfire season, you can now tap into a new online map to learn the level of fire risk in your immediate area and resources for finding help in an emergency. This digital tool allows San Diegans to search the county by address or place name in order to learn the degree of wildfire hazard and how to better prepare for an emergency. Many of the county's biggest blazes have struck this fall, fed by Santa Ana winds and tinderbox conditions in the backcountry. Supervisor Diane Jacob says wildfire is a year-round threat in our region, but fall can be especially brutal. The online map is an eye-opening reminder of the risks we face, but it also provides critical information on fire protection and preparedness. A link to the new wildfire hazard map can be found at www.readysandiego.org. It draws on existing data collected by California fire officials to assess conditions on properties statewide. The map shows large areas of the county, mostly in the backcountry, are high to very high hazard zones as defined by state officials. Other areas fall into moderate category or are not considered a serious risk. When an address or place name is entered, the map provides the hazard designation along with related links and information, including the names of the fire protection agency for that location, the closest fire station, and a detailed guide to fire preparedness. Many addresses also provide contact information for the local Fire Safe Council, a network of nonprofits that promote fire safety and preparedness. The map is available on both desktop and mobile devices.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. I'd like to talk to you now about why we call fall our planting season in Southern California. Obviously, we don't want to plant in August and September when it is so hot and so miserable. So what would we want to plant now and why? Well, for now, even though the rains may not have started, and I'm talking about October, November, December, the nights are cooler, the days are cooler, we don't have those August heat waves of 100 degrees, and once the Santa Anas are through, it's a great time to get things in the ground. What's the best thing to plant now? Now is the time to put in your trees, your native plants, your fall flowers that you pick up at the local nursery, and not to plant tropicals. We don't put in any tropicals now. By tropicals, I mean all the plants you think of when you think of Hawaii, everything you think of when you think of house plants that can grow outdoors. These are all tropical plants that are subject to being frosted. They don't like cold winter weather, so don't put them in the ground now. If you are in a very frost-prone area, then what you don't want to do is plant your citrus, your avocados, and anything tender right now. Think about where the plants originated. You don't have to look up every single plant that you want to grow, but if something is called Japanese something or other, that means that it will get by with cold weather, and you don't have to worry about planting it now. If it's something that's called Hawaiian something, I would be very leery of planting it in the fall because it's probably highly subject to freezes and frosts. Why would you want to plant natives now, and why would you want to put in shrubs and landscape plants now? The plants that you put in now will not show much visible growth during the winter time, but underground, all sorts of exciting things will be happening. The roots will be growing. The plants will be sitting there waiting to get started in the spring when it first gets to be hot weather. They'll take off like gangbusters. Maybe you went to the Water Conservation Garden and you saw the Chinese pistache trees. If you haven't been there to see them, I recommend you go. In the fall, they turn the most glorious color of red and orange. It's hard to describe how beautiful they are. This is also the time of year when you see the liquid ambers showing off, the sweet gum trees. They look great right now. How do you know you're going to buy one that looks wonderful for you? Now's the time. Go to the nursery now and look at the tree colors of the ones that you like and pick ones that change the colors that you like. There will be some variation in your yard because possibly your yard doesn't get as cold or isn't quite as wet or has a different kind of soil than the nursery has, but it's the best way to get the tree that you want for some gorgeous fall foliage. Why am I not telling you to plant your fruit trees now? Because you can save so much money if you wait until January. That's when the nurseries and the big box stores bring in the bare root plants. And when we get closer to that season, we'll have another session on here, and I'll give you all the instructions to have a great start on trees that will cost you $13 if you buy them in December or January, but they'll cost you $35 or $40 if you buy them in May.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.